You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
And kind of this chaotic aftermath of the Soviet Union, we don't actually always know where kind of nuclear waste went or nuclear materials went. So there was a certain amount of fissile material, not to be alarmist, that, you know, from this time perhaps is untraceable.
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app or join our emailing list at coldwarconversations.com.
In this episode, we speak with Dr. Becky Alexis Martin, who is a lecturer in cultural and political geography at Manchester Metropolitan University. She is the author of Disarming Doomsday, The Human Impact of Nuclear Weapons Since Hiroshima. If you like what you're hearing, then from the price of a cup of coffee a month, you can help us cover our increasing costs and keep us on the air, as well as receive a Cold War Conversations coaster, this year's sought-after household accessory. Just go to coldwarconversations.com and click on the Support the Podcast menu option. Thank you so much to our current and latest patrons. We welcome Dr. Becky Alexis Martin to our Cold War conversation. I'm here today with Dr. Becky Alexis Martin, lecturer in cultural and political geography at Manchester Metropolitan University. We're going to be talking mainly today about her latest book, Disarming Doomsday, The Human Impact of Nuclear Weapons Since Hiroshima. Welcome, Becky.
Thank you. I'm very excited to be on your podcast today. Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here. So I've recently written a book called Disarming Doomsday. And as you said, it explores the human impact of nuclear weapons since Hiroshima. So this book is basically an international exploration of the past, present and future spaces of nuclear warfare technologies. So it takes in everything from kind of the secret histories of Hiroshima and Nagasaki and Los Alamos to kind of anticipated future risks.
Okay. Well, I've been lucky enough to have a preview copy of this, and I must admit, I found it a very interesting read. It took me to places I didn't expect to necessarily go to, but it was all good Cold War stuff. And what I wanted to do was just talk about some of the chapters that you've got in there so that we can give listeners a taste of what they're in store for with this book. And the first chapter straight away intrigued me because you talk about the radical geography of nuclear warfare. Now, I've not heard of the term radical geography before, so can you explain that a little bit?
Absolutely. So radical geographies present an intersectional, a post-colonial or a feminist approach. So it presents the other side of any conditional story or any particular geography. So in the context of nuclear warfare, it's considering, for instance, what's left unmapped. So we know that maps can be sources of injustice. They can be used to deny knowledge as a tool to disguise the presence of secret places where nuclear weapons were developed, to hide the traces of things that perhaps history would rather forget. You know, they camouflage things that perhaps were never mapped before, you know. It's this idea of kind of remapping and remaking nuclear warfare and kind of the nature of perhaps what could be described as an institutional and cultural amnesia. So we need nuclear geographies because we need to understand the social and the spatial kind of challenges that are created by nuclear warfare and to advocate solutions. And a radical approach is committed to, intellectualizing, supporting and building perhaps alternatives to nuclear warfare. you know, it explores things like the ecological imperialism of nuclear weapons and the impacts to these hidden communities, perhaps colonized peoples, for instance, in the places where the nuclear weapons were tested.
Okay, and I think we may come on to that in some of the other chapters. One chapter you've got here is A Secret History. Now, what is still secret, really, from the Cold War? Because, I mean, most people consider this was, 30 years ago the Cold War effectively ended, and you'd think we'd know about most things.
You would think that we'd know about most things, and there is a lot of material out there. We've had a lot of documents that have been declassified both in US and UK and South African archives. I'll talk a bit about that later, perhaps. So we can kind of go away and learn about kind of the spaces and places of nuclear war. However, there are still a lot of contestations that surround kind of the history of nuclear warfare because there was a culture of secrecy surrounding nuclear weapons. This arose because, for a few different reasons. So it arose because there was the need for national security at a time when, there was the space race, there was the arms race, and these, the countries, the places and spaces like Soviet Russia, like America, like China, like the UK and France were essentially almost in competition with each other. And so there was a necessity for secrecy. These activities had to be clandestine to ensure that technologies were not shared, to ensure that secrets were not shared as well, that could have been detrimental. However, while much of the Cold War has been revealed, some of it is still secret due to neglect or due to kind of a necessity to preserve secrecy. So we have some documents that are still considered to be secret that surround the geopolitics and the technologies of nuclear warfare. And we also have places and spaces that are just neglected, that have essentially almost fallen into dereliction and ruin because we're not aware of them, because we don't think of them. So, for instance, a classic example, perhaps, in Manchester, where we are today, would be the Guardian Exchange Tunnels. So these were built originally in the 1950s. And the purpose of these tunnels was to protect state rather than society should there be an atom bomb, an atomic bomb like Hiroshima, detonated over Manchester. However, the development of technology was such that by the time the tunnels were completed, they had actually become redundant because the world had developed thermonuclear weapons. So these tunnels, they were repurposed. They were used for telephone exchange and they've become redundant now. They kind of exist in a state of dereliction where not everybody is aware of them, where there is not public access to them. But they're still there. They're still present, but you can't visit them. So they remain, secret to most people.
Yes.
For example.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I've always wanted to have a look in the Guardian Exchange tunnels. So if there's anybody listening who can give me a tour, that would make a great episode.
Absolutely.
Okay, so one of the areas I did find interesting you exploring was the health effects on service people who were involved in the nuclear tests, but also the effect on the existing communities that lived in those areas, because there's this concept of empty spaces, whereas nowhere is ever really empty. There's always somebody living there.
Absolutely. And so while there is fairly good awareness, hopefully, of the effects to the British nuclear test veterans, the US nuclear test veterans, the Chinese and the Russian men who tested nuclear weapons, and there are effects. And some of the things that I've noticed during my research with nuclear families are the presence of conditions that could be described as post-traumatic stress, anxiety, and other health conditions that are associated with traumatic service in particular, because I'm a social scientist, so I deal with the social side of things on the most part. But with these indigenous populations, such as the islanders of Kerasimas, where the grapple series of British nuclear weapon tests were undertaken. There has been a definite effect, and again we see the similar psychosocial consequences to these communities. So I spoke to the elders of these communities last summer. I was lucky enough to go and undertake an ethnography of Fijian Kurisimas, and what I found is that in addition to the traumatic effects of having nuclear weapons tested unexpectedly in their own in their own land, in their own space, several of the older women of the community told me about how they'd become profoundly deaf at an early age, and they attributed this to the sound of hearing these enormous hydrogen bombs going off. However, there are other effects that are perhaps more diffuse. So if we want to think about the Australian tests and the Aboriginal Indigenous communities, then there have been, there's been a very significant legacy of consequences. And these have arisen as the Aboriginal communities were moved away from their homelands. They were taken away from their traditional space, and they were an inherently nomadic community as well, so it was a complete change of lifestyle for them. There's been quite severe mental health effects, and also the incidence of things like substance abuse, as these communities have tried to reconcile the way that they've been treated by state in this forced relocation.
Right. I was interested to read also about the Soviet experience as well, because I think some of it, we're familiar with Christmas Island and Montebello, I think, and some of these other South Pacific tests, but some of the Soviet tests and the way those populations were treated.
Oh, it's absolutely shocking. And definitely something that should be spoken about. So the Soviet Union undertook 715 nuclear weapon tests from 1949 to 1999 in a space called Novaya Zemlya and what are now known, which were part of the former USSR but are now independent countries, the places of Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan. Despite locations being chosen that were remote from the main kind of population, the main community, they were not remote for the indigenous communities there. So one particular space that I wanted to talk about a little more is the Semipalatinsk test site, or the polygon. It's nestled in the Kazakh steppes, and 1 million people lived within 160 kilometres of the test site. So these communities were left in place over a 40-year period, where 456 individual nuclear weapon tests took place from 1949 to 1989, of which 116 of these tests were airburst tests, so they were above ground. This has definitely impacted the community, and the region is still heavily contaminated. The community are aware of contamination to their land, but are too poor to relocate, so they're fated to live their lives in this toxic environment. So there's been lots of kind of health problems associated with this. There are birth defects in the region, a lot of things that you would associate with high level radiation exposure. It's very interesting, actually. There was a study undertaken where they were kind of describing and exploring the stigma associated with their fate, and thinking about kind of the effect of radiation upon their homelands. However, this isn't even the last community to think about. So another neglected nuclear community is the Uyghur Autonomous Region in China, where the Lop Nur nuclear weapons test site was placed. And within this community, again, the Uyghur people were left in place during the nuclear weapon tests and were not supported or compensated. So the Uyghur are an indigenous community. So if we compare them to the Han, which is kind of the majority Chinese community, they were very much othered. They've since been subject to lot of kind of subjugation by state. So if you go online now and you pop in Uyghur, you will see, into your search engine, you will see that they have been quite persecuted. It's arguable that these original nuclear weapon tests, while also having an effect to the community directly, have manifested this long-term consequence, this long-term effect. And this links into one of the things that I'm very interested in, actually, is kind of how these, supposedly empty spaces, how the people of these empty spaces, what their long-term outcomes are and kind of what their lives are like, and the reverberations, the repercussion, consequences of these nuclear weapon tests.
Yeah. Do you think these populations were left in place so they could research some of the effects of these weapons or not?
I don't know. I'd hope not. I'd really hope not. I think for the British and American tests, populations were not intentionally left in place for those purposes. But within the context of the Soviet tests in Kazakhstan, the villagers, were left in place and were not moved in any way. They weren't provided with any protection. And this was ongoing, for decades. And the community definitely experienced subacute radiation injuries at the time of the blasts. We know that from the 1960s to the 1980s, in this space, childhood leukemia increased, particularly among women who of reproductive age who are exposed to radiation during childhood, they were more likely to have malformations among their children. So after 1985, when the tests decreased, the frequency of these congenital malformations dropped, and infant mortality eventually decreased to pre-test levels. But this is one of the reasons why we know that radiation effects have arisen, because you've had this change after testing.
Yeah.
Decreased. But to hypothesize whether it was an intentional scenario or not, brings in some very interesting and complex ethical dilemmas.
You also talk about nuclear tourism, which is an interesting concept, because I, for one, like to go and look at old Cold War air bases. I was at Upper Heyford a couple of weekends back. I'm at Hack Green at their nuclear bunker this weekend coming up. But there is an increased interest in this period now.
Absolutely. I find it very interesting, because when we think of phanotourism, so dark tourism, for instance, visiting somewhere like Chernobyl, somewhere like Hack Green, a lot of it is around kind of trying to understand our history or our heritage, or memorialization of that event. However, it's one of those really multifaceted things, really. You get, for instance, when we think about the zone in Chernobyl and Pripyat, there's a lot of kind of thrill-seeking tourism almost. People want to go there to be able to say they've been.
And because it's a forbidden zone.
Exactly.
As well.
So I'd actually like to turn that question back round to you and ask you why you go. It'd be very interesting for my research.
God, I'm a guinea pig now.
Yes.
Scary. I'm being interviewed. That's not supposed to happen. If you take Upper Heyford as an example, I'm just fascinated by the sort of the business that they did there. The fact that they had, the quick reaction alert section where these bombers were ready to fly off at 4 minutes notice. The double chain link fence security they've got around the place. I mean, when I went round, we were talking to one of the former military police guys there who was showing us round, and it was interesting what their instructions were in the event that somebody tried to cross into those areas. And it sort of comes back to almost my childhood, because growing up in the 60s and 70s, the Cold War was always there. The threat of nuclear weapons was there. I did manage to see the War Game, despite the BBC not showing it on TV. Threads was obviously of massive impact to people as well. And there was the rise of, the campaign for nuclear disarmament and all of that side of things. I'm not sure I've answered the question.
I think you have, but I mean, you've described how it kind of links into your own experiences, your own legacy and your interest in heritage. And I think often that these nuclear spaces are inherently quite interesting places, just because they're so contrived, they're so designed, they have this, solitary purpose, this sole aim. That aim relates to, what is essentially kind of one of the most bombastic weapons we have ever developed as humanity. So I feel that to kind of gain an insight into these places and spaces, whether they relate to protection or to warfare itself, is it's kind of inherently thought-provoking and intriguing.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think it's also around how close we came to things going wrong. I did an interview quite a few months back around the Able Archer exercise and the nuclear war scare in 1983. And I think that whole misunderstanding between the two superpowers as to intentions was fascinating. How
you're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
Things could just get completely misread by the opposition. And from what I can make out, it was, Gordievsky, the KGB double agent, who wasn't the only one that saved the day, but made the Russians realize, actually, perhaps it's not what we think. And there was the Soviet, the Stasi agent Topaz, Rainer Rupp, who was feeding back to through the Stasi as well. And, it's interesting, how close, because I very much remember the film The War Game. War Games, the computer, the one where the computer runs amok.
Yeah.
And remember watching that and finding that of a lot of impact. Anyway, this is coming about me, not about you. What's going on?
It's very interesting, though, that kind of link between the tourism and the culture. So, and I think that we live in a world where we are surrounded by nuclear culture. Whether you can turn on The Simpsons and within the first 3 minutes you have nuclear culture staring you in the face from the site of that green radioactive rod. You go to play a computer game, you can play, any series of Fallout, you can dig out your Pip Boys. There's so many films, there's so many documentaries surrounding nuclear war, and it's a bit natural to kind of want to learn a bit more about these spaces and places. And as you just mentioned, then there is so much that is unresolved, there's so much that comes to light through the work of excellent archivists and investigators. And if you don't mind, may I name drop a couple who are doing some very interesting work at the moment. So for instance, the work of Emily Gibbs at Liverpool University on nuclear anxiety, and also the work of Dr. Chris Hill, who's currently undertaking this amazing exploration of kind of what actually happened and the nuclear imperialism of the Saharan nuclear weapon tests. So there's still so much to learn.
Yeah, so that was the French nuclear weapon
test. Yeah, in Algeria.
Okay. You talk about civil defence and that sort of preparing for the doomsday scenario with nuclear weapons, but also that whole prepper survivalist side of things as well.
I am highly intrigued by survivalists. I find them absolutely fascinating. And my first encounter with the prepper community was in 2016. So I was very lucky to be guesting with Dr. Stephanie Malin, who is a brilliant professor of environmental sociology at Colorado State University. So she looks at kind of the other side of things. She looks at uranium mining and social justice. Mm-hmm. And while I was there, I was lucky enough, it was just before Trump was elected, and there was this atmosphere. It was sparky. It was strange. We all knew that something was going to happen. And so I decided I was going to talk to the communities who were most concerned. And the American Midwest, it's it's a very strange place anyway. You go to New Mexico, you go to Colorado, you go to Utah, and it has this incredible, geography. It's beautiful, but it's kind of quite bleak and quite desertified in places. And it seems like the ideal place that somebody might go if they were going to try and escape humanity and escape society. So I interviewed some preppers to kind of learn about their perspectives and their understandings of, what might happen next. And I found it really interesting, actually, because there's this demographic shift. So the older communities that I spoke to, say baby boomer generation, or I don't really like that term, were far more concerned about the future risk of nuclear warfare than those who might be called millennial, who are my own age, whose concerns surrounded issues such as climate change or civil unrest. So they were more worried about kind of other ways that that society could collapse. But there was very much kind of this culture of existential dread. So it's really interesting to kind of explore and understand. And one of the things I found fascinating is that I did this 3 years ago now, just over. And since then, we have seen a real cultural shift. It has become less niche. It's become more of a kind of dominant cultural meme. We've seen the emergence of programs like Preppers on American TV. We've seen, in the UK, we see quite regularly see articles about kind of prepper culture and about, how to prepare for Brexit. And it's gone from being this, being something that was undertaken in the vastness of America, where justifiably and understandably you have these natural conditions that mean that actually prepping is probably quite sensible. You've got more severe weather, you're more isolated if you don't live in one of the big cities, to this arising in our own tiny little, highly populated island as we kind of anticipate future catastrophe. So it's been very curious.
Indeed. I think one of the other areas you cover around is geography, which we've covered to some degree, but also around military war games and scenarios.
Yeah, so I think they're really interesting from a perspective of kind of these, the nuclear sublime, the nuclear imaginary, the maps, models and war games, kind of a way you might prepare for a, impossibly bleak nuclear future. And the way that they've been used over the last 70 years is really intriguing for kind of justification, evasion or affirmation of existential threat of nuclear warfare. I always think it's very interesting how maps and models are presented, because a lot of the time they're put as, unbiased factual figures. But this isn't always necessarily the case. So, for instance, if we think of Wild Bill Bungie, he was a geographer and a half.
Wild Bill Bungie's
Atlas of Nuclear War. He was a cartographer, and he created this highly politicized Cold War map that depicts this desolate world after nuclear attacks. So it's got these very unusual symbologies. Whereas normally you might have parks and trees, his maps contain disintegrating radioactive zombies stumbling through a derelict wasteland, alongside actually quite accurate models of for the time of perceived effects of nuclear warfare. And his work was really important, actually, because it provided this rebellious aesthetic for the risks that were keenly felt by many during the Cold War. So it's quite intriguing. We've had technological advances that have meant that while we kind of provide more accurate and realistic representations of risk, and there are also, more sensationalist scenarios that are emerging. So I saw a particular example that was kind of proliferating across tabloids not that long ago, where you could kind of create a very old-fashioned blast radius, this perfect circle of obliteration, should nuclear warfare arise, anywhere you like. So while it's really kind of thought-provoking and fun and interesting, it also has this other side of whether we're providing an accurate representation, and kind of how it links into things like kind of Cold War propaganda at the time and how we represented nuclear warfare during the Cold War. So,
but even, CND and people like that would use that geography or that those sort of diagrams to show, if you live 15 miles away, your windows and your roof will come off, and that sort of stuff as well. So it's almost
absolutely.
As though it wasn't just government propaganda, but peace movement as well.
Yeah, precisely. And I think it's very interesting, actually, how, as I mentioned in Bill Bungie's case, these maps have been repurposed. They've been taken and you know, re-represented and re-described. So.
Okay, now there is so much in this book that we can cover. So,
thank you.
One of the areas I was interested in was you had a chapter on called Spaces of Irregularity, and some of that was around the near misses. But I was interested to talk to you about, you know, the, like, for example, the breakup of the Soviet Union and the nuclear weapons then, because, I mean, obviously Kazakhstan is now an independent state, yet it was the main nuclear, or one of the main nuclear test centres. So how was all of that dealt with?
In the aftermath, so from a nuclear perspective, it was quite complex, and to be honest, perhaps it wasn't dealt with as well as it should have been. During that process, nuclear weapons weren't immediately relinquished. So there were different kind of pacts and different procedures that arose as treaties and policies changed. It was quite interesting, actually, because a nuclear-free zone formed as part of these kind of former Soviet countries decided that actually they didn't want the bomb anymore. But one of the big issues surrounding places like Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan and Belarus, of course, is that in kind of this chaotic aftermath of the Soviet Union, we don't actually always know where kind of nuclear waste went or nuclear materials went. So there was a certain amount of fissile material, not to be alarmist, that from this time perhaps is untraceable, and this could be due to kind of miscalculations, this could be due to bad kind of material accounting. However, there are organisations in place who are trying to kind of document and make sure that we're, that we can kind of account for a lot of the materials, from this time.
Yeah. I was interested in some of the near misses that you describe. We've obviously covered Abel Archer and in 1983, but one that I was particularly intrigued with, which is post-Cold War, is the 1993 one involving Boris Yeltsin.
So this is a very interesting one, actually. On the 25th of January 1995, Russian radar systems misinterpreted a small rocket that was launched by a Norwegian research vessel as a ballistic missile. And so Boris Yeltsin, who was president at the time, activated his nuclear briefcase. This caused considerable consternation, and it almost created a second Cold War scenario between the US and between Russia. And as recently as October 2010, so the 23rd of October 2010, US military officials at an Air Force base in Wyoming lost most forms of command, control and security monitoring over 50 nuclear ICBMs for 45 minutes due to a hardware problem. So there's these near misses that arise. And going back to this idea of kind of secrecy and what is still secret as well, it's very interesting kind of when these misses become revealed and whether they kind of enter the public domain immediately, or whether they enter the public domain at a later date. I suspect there's near misses that perhaps we'll never know.
Yeah, no, absolutely, absolutely. I'm always learning new stuff. I'm always discovering more. You then move on to the peace movement, which is an area, yes, of interest to me. I have interviewed somebody who was with, still is with, CND, and was on some of the early Aldermaston marches. That's a future episode for people to look forward to.
That sounds amazing. I will be tuning in.
Good. That's what I like to hear. So you talk about some of the anti-nuclear scientists, which are interesting, because there's that whole thing with Oppenheimer, where he sort of turned against nuclear weapons.
Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating. So we all know about kind of, Oppenheimer's distaste towards nuclear weapons after his time working on the bomb at Los Alamos. But quite often, you're not so aware of what happened afterwards. So there was the Szilard petition, which was signed by a committee of 68 Manhattan Project scientists who were in moral opposition to the atomic bomb. And, it was delivered to President Truman in July 1945. And so he continued to, he ignored their pleas. He bombed Hiroshima and Nagasaki on the 6th of August and the 9th of August, 1945. And many other scientists kind of became these staunch anti-nuclear activists when they saw the effects of nuclear warfare. So included Albert Einstein, Leo Szilard, many different members, from critical theorist Lewis Mumford to Linus Pauling, who won a Nobel Peace Prize for his work to try and stop atmospheric nuclear testing of weapons. Across the Atlantic, though, it's quite interesting. So all that was kind of the US movement, but we also have the Polish physicist Joseph Rotblat, who formed the Atomic Scientists Association, which was a politically neutral group with kind of similar aims to the American scientists, the Emergency Committee of Atomic Scientists, as they called themselves, these Szilard petitioners. These communities kind of formed non-governmental organizations in science and medicine to try and prevent nuclear war and weapons testing, which kind of heralded a new move towards non-violent internationalism. I think the most famous scenario, though, and when we think about scientists and peace, is when Bertrand Russell and Albert Einstein got together, to the kind of greatest minds of history, really, hooked up to create this pacifist manifesto, which they issued on the 9th of July, 1955. And this manifesto, it called for world peace. It called, for the world leaders to find these peaceful solutions to conflict. And again, it was signed by experts, signed by Rotblat, Born, Einstein, Russell, lots and lots of different, eminent intellectuals of the time.
And Bertrand Russell went on to form the Committee of 100, didn't he?
Yeah, he did.
There's that famous photo of him in a sit-down in Trafalgar Square, yeah, gazing at the camera.
Absolutely, yeah. And they were well-known rabble-rousers. They used to break into facilities in order to kind of get information.
Spies for peace, weren't there?
Yeah,
Who revealed the existence of the regional government centres in the event of nuclear war.
Absolutely. And that caused considerable consternation and unrest among the public once they became aware that the purpose of this kind of Cold War preparedness was for the survival of state rather than society. And it was one of the things that I think eventually kind of led to the change in attitude towards civil defense.
Absolutely. I think you're right, because one area that I don't know whether you've looked at is how civil defense is treated in other countries. So, for example, with Sweden, any new build needed nuclear shelter. And I think Switzerland was pretty similar as well.
I haven't explored that in great detail yet. Wait for the next book. But I did consider it from a perspective of kind of how the creation of civil defense was used by different governments to try and understand proliferation during the Cold War. So, for instance, in Russia, there were many, many kind of public shelters built during the time when nuclear weapons were being developed and tested. And the US and the UK used this as an indicator of Russia's kind of nuclear capacity at that time, which I think is quite interesting.
Absolutely, because I mean there were fears of Soviet infiltration into the peace movement. They had their own, I think it was the International Peace Council or something like
Yeah, they did, absolutely. And it was very interesting as well, because a lot of the time there was this kind of conflation between the peaceful activist and the communist as well, so they were kind of classified with the same apparent slur at the time, and peace activism did not have a good name during the Cold War. And a lot of that was due to, the government propaganda at the time. So.
An interesting piece that I heard when I was touring Upper Heyford is that there was a peace camp right next to the airfield.
Yeah.
And some of the peace campaigners have come to visit the airbase as it is now because they're really interested to see exactly what they were trying to get rid of. And that the peace activists would like the airbase to be preserved as well as the military historians and the military veterans.
That is so interesting and quite understandable as well, because it can serve both as a memorial but also a warning. So I can see and understand all perspectives. I think it's quite interesting, actually, because when we reflect upon nuclear heritage, often you do find that those who are pacifist, as well as those who perhaps are military participants or who have other interests, perhaps historic interests in these architectures and artifacts, do want them to be preserved. They want the spaces to be opened up for this secrecy, as you said, very pertinently, to be unveiled.
Yeah. You might find one of my other episodes interesting, which is entitled Why Preserve Communist Architecture, where I talk with Mark Baker, who's he writes for Lonely Planet and lives in Prague, and talks about, why this architecture should be, preserved as a piece of history rather than an ideology.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War, because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War. As a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
Absolutely. I think that's fascinating. And he sounds like a very interesting chap. I'll have to go check it out. There is a need to remember and to reflect upon history and to kind of understand the context and the spaces that were involved in, that moment from, the Trinity test on the 6th of July 1945 onwards. As we know, when we think about the Trinity test, there's an open day every year where people can go and visit. And I've seen photographs from Martin Pfeiffer, who's down at Los Alamos University. He's fantastic, great ethnographer. They show the Trinity test site being opened up, and we're parents there with buggies who've taken their buggies across the desert. There are old people, very young people, because they want to try and, understand what it means to live in a nuclear age, I think.
Yeah. So. Yeah. I mean, what is there to see at the Trinity test site apart from a crater? Is there a crater there or not?
I don't think there's much to see. It's a memorial.
It's just being there.
Yeah, but it's being
there.
Yeah.
First test was done. Yeah, no,
yeah,
I understand
exactly.
That.
So it's not even necessarily about having the architecture in place, having a bunker to explore or a silo to visit or a museum to look at or a derelict town to walk around. It's about being able to experience and see that nuclear space. And I think it links into kind of the nature of radiation itself, because it is inherently, it's invisible. We can't taste it. We can't touch it. We can't smell it. So therefore, I think there's also an invisibility that accompanies kind of these nuclear and radioactive places. We don't necessarily need to have something there to be able to recollect or to think or reflect upon kind of the power of the warfare itself.
I think you're right. I mean, it's a bit like visiting a former battlefield.
Mm,
I mean,
exactly,
most of
yeah.
You visit a former battlefield and it's a field with trees and cows and usual stuff, but it's the context of what's actually happened on that soil and in that land.
And the extraordinary and unusual nature of it. Mm. So, and I think this is one of the reasons why places like, for instance, Maralinga in Australia are becoming popular sites of tourism. Because there is very, you know, there are often these vast open spaces with perhaps no evidence of the test beyond a memorial. But for those who visit, they want to kind of recollect and consider this astonishing event that arose many years ago.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Now, your final chapter, again, I found really interesting about countries that sort of wanted nuclear weapons and then decided, actually, we don't need them. And I came across a few months back that Sweden actually got into some quite serious research about having their own nuclear weapons.
That is so interesting.
I'll try and dig out where I found that reference.
But yeah, no, that would be absolutely fascinating, because I know that Sweden opted for conventional kinetic approaches instead of nuclear weapons. I know that there's other places, there are other spaces. So there were states that kind of began to prepare for nuclear warfare, but then chose to kind of disarm or halt this proliferation. So Taiwan and South Korea both halted their plutonium production programs in the 1960s, and Argentina and Brazil both decided against any nuclear aspirations by the 1990s. Now, as you know, this is particularly interesting at the moment because with a change of leadership, Brazil looks like it may not be a nuclear state, a nuclear-free state, rather, for perpetuity, as there's aspirations now for kind of ownership of nuclear submarines, which is really interesting because Brazil was part of the Rarotonga Treaty and these other treaties that created nuclear-free zones. So that is going to change the geopolitical dynamic quite dramatically if Brazil goes ahead with this. The classic place, though, that I would like to talk about or think about as far as nuclear warfare but never was is concerned, is South Africa. So because it had this nuclear weapons program, it had quite a developed and quite sophisticated nuclear weapons program. But then it dismantled its nuclear warheads and abandoned this program by 1989. Going back to what we were talking about earlier, thinking about what happened to these other places in the Soviet Union, we had Ukraine, Kazakhstan and Belarus who all decided to surrender their nuclear weapons that they'd inherited from the Soviet Union in 1991 to try and support the creation of this Central Asian nuclear weapon-free zone.
Right. And who did they surrender them to? Did they hand them back to Russia or...?
I think they went back to Russia.
Right, so. Okay. That has been a fascinating talk about your book. It's called Disarming Doomsday, The Human Impact of Nuclear Weapons Since Hiroshima, and it's published by Pluto Press. There will be links in the show notes, but I do recommend it. It's very thought-provoking.
Thank you.
And Becky is appearing at various locations promoting the book. Becky.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. So I'm going to be having a couple of book launches. I'll be talking at Blackwell's Manchester on the 23rd of May. And I've got my big launch at the National Archives on the 4th of July. So please do come down. I'll be very happy to see you if you can.
Yes. No, please do. Please do. Now, Becky, our regular listeners will know that I have a little bit of a quick fire round, which is a little bit of fun, just to give us a little bit more insight into you. The first question I have is, what is your favourite Cold War movie?
That is a great question. And I'm afraid it's a bit of a classic. It's Where the Wind Blows, because I love Raymond Briggs' illustration, the way that he kind of depicts this couple in the aftermath of the bomb. And it's got an amazing soundtrack as well. It's got David Bowie, and who doesn't love a bit of David Bowie? And also, I don't know if it kind of still falls into kind of the idea of a favourite movie, but I love the public information films. So I love things like Protect and Survive.
Is that the one with Patrick, I can't remember his surname, who does the voiceover?
Yes, yeah. So.
Oh, I've forgotten his name now, but he's a very well-known actor of that era.
Yeah. They're very, I think they're really kind of interesting and thought-provoking because they're so, so fatalistic. And also because I find it quite curious that they were produced by the same director, Richard Taylor Cartoons, who also did the Charlie Say series. So.
Oh, okay. So these were these child safety films they used to show on TV. I remember them, sadly. I remember seeing these. But Protect and Survive is particularly eerie, particularly that music, that electronic music they have on the intro and the outro. And When the Wind Blows is just so sad. This couple just place complete trust in the government and what they're being told is the right thing to do. And, all worth watching.
Very much so, I think. So.
Okay. So those are your favourite Cold War movies. You managed to sneak in more than one there. So what Cold War incident would you make into a movie?
Well, I wouldn't go for an incident so much as a very interesting story. So I want to talk about Russia's Cold War cartographers because there are so many unresolved questions that I think would make this incredible story of espionage. So during the Cold War, the Soviet Union had one of the most ambitious cartography programs of its time. It went around mapping places down to the level of the individual building. Now, those of you who know the other side of my work will know that I do modelling for radiation protection when I'm not doing kind of nuclear culture. And it is so hard to do this. It's really difficult. You have to be in place to get it completely accurate. And definitely during at that time, you know, before drone technologies, it would have been essential to be there. So these Soviet maps of kind of American cities have all these details that weren't on domestic maps at the same time. So things like kind of the width of roads, the load-bearing capacity of bridges and the types of facilities. So things that you would want to know but would be virtually impossible without to discover without having people there covertly and secretly, you know, snooping out these details. And so it's very curious, you know, what was going on? How was this data collected? It would make a fantastic story, I think.
It would. It sounds a bit like The Americans.
Have you
seen that series?
No, I haven't.
Oh, I recommend it. It's this undercover couple.
Yeah.
Soviet agents who are deep. Very deep undercover, set up as a travel agent, and they've got kids who don't know that they're doing the spying.
Oh,
it's
wow.
In six seasons.
Yeah.
And it's brilliant. It's brilliant.
That sounds amazing.
It's a very good film. But sorry, back to these maps. I'm presuming you've seen the John Ryland collection of Soviet maps of Manchester.
They are so beautiful and interesting, and I love I feel so lucky to be here actually, because there's so many amazing resources. We've also got the Working Class People's Movement Library, I think it's Movement Library, in the city just near Salford, and that has an incredible collection of Soviet and pacifist propaganda, essentially, from the time as well. So it's a really good place to research the Cold War and to research the nuclear.
We like to cover all angles on Cold War conversations. We're not just doing the military. I like to try and capture different viewpoints. So that definitely sounds like it's worth a visit. So we've got the movie. What would be your Cold War soundtrack? What music do you think sums up the Cold War for you?
Well, I had to really wrap my brains about this. I thought originally of maybe going for kind of one of the Cold War classics. But In the end, I actually went for Morrissey every day is like Sunday. The reason why is because I spent some of my misspent youth in this very derelict little seaside town, and used to wander around with my Walkman, old enough for a Walkman, and listen to Morrissey, you know, with a big coat, hands in my pockets, looking grumpy. And it was perhaps my first introduction to the possibility of nuclear warfare.
Right. This is all cheerful stuff you're coming through with here. What with When the Wind Blows is your favourite movie.
Yes.
Morrissey is your soundtrack.
Yeah, very upbeat.
Okay, so last question. If you could ask three people from the Cold War, living or dead, for a drink, who would they be and what would you ask them?
I'd invite Lise Mietner, who was the Los Alamos nuclear physicist who never was. So a lot of the time her work is misattributed to Project Y at Los Alamos. But she was an incredible physicist, even though she didn't participate in this work. So I'd love to know her perspective about this misattribution and her thoughts on kind of the male scientists of Los Alamos.
Why did they misattribute her?
It was due to the secrecy that surrounded the site, I think, and the fact that she was a relatively prominent woman at the time. So, and it's very interesting that she kind of became a figurehead and became quite well known, and while not directly contributing any science, while at the same time there were women who were working in Los Alamos whose kind of work and lives have been rarely recognised. And instead we kind of talk about these prominent men.
Yeah. I was going to say it's a bit early for them to be promoting diversity at Los Alamos.
Yeah, no, it is. But it's quite interesting because Los Alamos itself was built and designed as this kind of picket-fenced village community to attract scientists and their families. So there were a lot of wives there who supported their husbands' work. But there were also scientists. There was the experimental chemist Isabella Carl, who worked on the chemistry of transuranic elements. There was Lily Hornig, who was a chemist at Los Alamos. She was asked to take a typing proficiency test, and she said, "I don't type," and explained instead her formidable credentials. And she was made a staff scientist and worked with plutonium salt chemistry before leading the development of explosive lenses for this outer packaging of a nuclear weapon that was used to kind of compress fissionable material and induce a critical state. So these are, oh God, I'm going over way more than three people.
She sounds great.
Do I get any more people? I have a contemporary person.
Yeah, go on.
Okay, we also have, I was also thinking about the work of Cynthia Lazaroff as well. So you should all go and check her out because she's an absolutely formidable, brilliant woman. And she was there during the Hawaiian Missile Crisis. So she documented the experience of actually living through this false alarm. And it was quite like the way she did it was really profound. And you know, can you imagine kind of living through that scenario? So I think she'd be a very interesting person to have at a dinner party.
Wow. Well, that's certainly three people we've never heard of before on Cold War Conversations. So I'm delighted that we've got somebody different there.
Thank you,
Becky. It's been great.
Thank you. It's been lovely.
It's been a pleasure. I learned a lot reading this book, and as I said at the start, I thought about things that I'd not thought about for, and I think that's always a sign of a good book is challenging people's thoughts and challenging people's opinions.
Oh, thank you. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure to be able to contribute to your podcast, and I will continue to be an avid listener for the foreseeable future, unless, of course, we have nuclear war.
What a cheerful ending to end this podcast on. Thank you, Becky.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for our chat with Becky. However, there's more information in the show notes, which are at coldwarconversations.com/episode and the number 62. If you like what you're hearing on the podcast, you can really help us by leaving reviews on iTunes, Stitcher, our Facebook page, or with your favorite podcast provider. This really helps raise our profile and get new guests on the show. If you can't wait for the next episode, do visit our Facebook discussion group where our guests and listeners like yourselves continue the Cold War conversation. Just search for Cold War Conversations on Facebook. We're also on Twitter at Cold War Pod and Instagram at Cold War Conversations. Thank you very much for listening. It is really appreciated. Goodbye.
Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.